Surrender. It's the greatest thing. Surrender is the greatest thing you'll ever do. Let it happen. I mean, pick your bumper sticker and go with it. Whichever one, all the bumper stickers are true, whether they sound ridiculous or not. Pick one and run with it.
That was Christopher Lee Falk, and this is the Share Podcast.
It's time for the Share Recovery Podcast, where we bring you amazing life-changing success stories from addicts and alcoholics all over the world who share their inspiring journey in recovery. And now, here's your host, Oh.
Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of the Share Podcast. And today we have Christopher Lee Falk joining us on the show. Chris is a peer recovery specialist, the founder of Recovery Rings, and a very active member in the Facebook private group. He has dedicated his life to recovery and being of service. But prior to finding recovery, Chris faced a brutal battle with drugs and alcohol, leaving years of wreckage behind him. One could say it's a miracle that Chris is alive today. It's a testament to recovery and the ability to connect with a higher power. So let's dive into Chris's story. But first, let's dive into a few of these iTunes reviews. So this first one I found really interesting, and it's from Alex B., and he writes, "Came across this podcast researching topics of addiction and recovery in an attempt to help an individual. I don't have problems with drugs or alcohol myself, but my family was rather dysfunctional. Those are simply amazing stories of people from all walks of life whose lives were virtually destroyed by their addictions. I listen to this podcast every day now and find it even more interesting than news or TV. Even people without addiction problems will benefit from it. Overall, highly, highly recommended, Alex B." Thank you so much, Alex, for this great review. And what I'm finding is more and more listeners and people that are writing in that are not actually suffering from addiction, but they are actively seeking solutions for the disease because they have a family member that's struggling and most likely wreaking havoc in their lives. So interestingly enough, I did have one of the members of the group reach out to me and ask me for help in reference to her boyfriend who is about to get out of rehab and come back home. And so what we decided to do was actually just to record our conversation. So coming up very soon is going to be an interview with Lizzie Edwards and myself discussing this topic for family members that are looking for ways to help their addicts. And that particular episode will probably be out in the next 6 to 8 weeks. Okay, so now let's move on to the next review. And the next one is from BooBoy88. And he writes, I hope it's a he, "If you need help battling addiction, listen to this. An amazing show which brings listeners who have suffered or are suffering currently from the disease of addiction. Great host and absolute star who knows his stuff and has walked the walk. Fabulous and divergent shares all carrying the same message, you can recover. HP, baby." And Boo Boy is from the UK. Thank you so much for the great review, Boo Boy. And HP, baby, it's so true. You can recover, we can recover, but we got to do this together. The Facebook private group is just booming. So much love, so much support. We're about to hit 2,000 members. We get new members every day now, and the participation is phenomenal. So if you haven't joined the Facebook private group, get in there. Again, it's private. So whatever you share in there, whatever feedback you get, whatever feedback you give is 100% private. No one from your personal Facebook group will see these posts. And that's why I created the group in the first place. So again, thanks for the amazing reviews. I'll be sharing more next week. And until then, let's dive into Chris's story. But first, if you have not yet rated and reviewed the Share Podcast, please, one of the best ways to help support the show is to go to iTunes, leave us a 5-star rating and a review, and that helps catapult us up the ratings on iTunes, which will make it easier for more and more people to find the Share Podcast. Now, in the past, many of you have asked, hey, how can I help support the show? Well, I'm going to keep it simple for you. The first way is by donating via PayPal or Bitcoin. And of course, I want to thank all of our listeners who have been generously donating every month to the Share Podcast. Make no mistake about it, you guys are making a huge difference. But again, we can always use more. And now you can even send us donations using Bitcoin. So if you go to the website, www.thesharepodcast.com, On the top right corner, there's a donate button. Click on that button and it'll take you to the page where you can donate either by PayPal or by Bitcoin. On a weekly basis, I have over 5,000 listeners every week who listen to the Share podcast. So if 100 of you guys would send me $5 a month or more, there are a few listeners that are sending $10, $20, and even $50 every month, that would completely support the show from beginning to end. So for those of you who have the wherewithal to send me $5, either by PayPal or by Bitcoin, then by all means, please feel free to donate now. We could really use the support. Also, when you're purchasing stuff on Amazon, there are those of you that are still clicking on the Amazon link on the Share Podcast website before doing their purchases on Amazon. But again, there are thousands of you listening. If each and every one of you could just remember to go to the Share website, click on the Amazon button before you do your shopping, that is also going to make a tremendous difference for us financially. So I haven't been one to emphasize it in the past, right? But now we've got a solid listener base. I know you guys love the show. I know you guys get a lot out of it. There are those of you, just like in the meetings, that are newcomers. The money's tight. Keep listening. The show will always be for free. The Share Podcast Private Accountability Group will always be for free. But for those of you who can, kick in a couple of bucks. Help us out here. And not to forget the Share Podcast Private Accountability Group. Again, it's growing like crazy. Guys, go to the Share Podcast, www.thesharepodcast.com. Click on the button that says Join the Facebook Private Group. For those of you that are in the Private Accountability Group, you know how vital and important that has become. There's over 1,500 members in there. If you don't want to go to meetings, if you have problems connecting with people, if you need something more than just the podcasts and are not ready to cross over into meetings or some other structured program, then the Private Accountability Group is perfect for you. Jump in there, make comments, ask questions, or just read the posts. There are so many people out there that have the same questions that you have. All you have to do is just read those and then read all the follow-up answers and responses that come. And make sure to subscribe to my weekly newsletter so you know every single time a brand new episode is launched. And of course, if you have any questions, just email me, o@thesharepodcast.com, and I'll get back to you as soon as possible. So now a quick message from our sponsors and then on to the show. Would you like to join a free, anonymous online group that offers a daily topic email with popular recovery resources accompanied by a secret Facebook group for discussion? Then go to dailyaaemails.com for more information about Transitions Daily. And don't forget to share dailyaaemails.com with friends, in meetings, and with sponsees in recovery. Sober Nation is the largest online recovery community and treatment resource center. They provide treatment resources to those struggling with addiction, as well as to the family members who are caught in the crossfire. On top of that, Sober Nation is a huge community of good people who share their experience with each other. They have informative content, recovery and addiction news, as well as an entire clothing line which helps expand the culture of recovery. They can easily be found at www.SoberNation.com. Sober Nation is putting recovery on the map. Hey, Chris, thanks for joining us.
Hey, all. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to have you on the show today, man. How you feeling?
Well, I have my moments, for sure. Having a good one right now.
All right. Good to know. We're in the moment right now. This is the now.
Amen.
All right, folks. So today we have Christopher Lee Falk joining us on the Share Podcast. And Chris is a peer recovery specialist, the founder of Recovery Rings, where he takes clean time recovery medallions and turns them into rings. And he is a very prominent member of the Share Podcast private group. So let's dive right in. So first, Chris, take us into your normal daily routine, including recovery.
I wake up every morning and I actually have this constant conscience contact with God. It's the first thing I think of is of God. So I make sure my knees hit the floor before my feet do every morning, you know, unless I got to run to the bathroom real quick. I'm getting kind of old. Then I come down and that's my first thing. And I start out with prayer. So as far as my day goes, you know, because I used to wake up like in fear from child support, first thing I used to think of, or, you know, all the bills I owed or the lies I told. So this is kind of a new thing for me, and it's awesome. It's one of the gracious gifts I got from God. But so that's how it starts out. Then basically I go to work. I'm still a construction worker. Trying to get out of it. I'm going to school as well for addiction counseling.
Right.
And so after my work at construction, I go to school because I hurry up and take a quick bike or shower. So I can either go to class or I go to my new job as a peer recovery specialist at a drug court here in the Twin Cities.
So tell us a little bit about the recovery rings. Like, where did you come up with that idea and how did that get started?
The recovery rings, it fell in my lap. I'm a bricklayer by trade, or a caulker, tuck pointer, cleaner. One day I seen this guy making a ring out of a silver Morgan dollar. They're pure silver, and he was beating it with a hammer and a mandrel, and I had my token on me, and I always lose my medallions, my AA medallions and my NA medallions. And I always thought, man, I need to figure out a way to make that, make that ring. So, you know, I Googled it, I looked, and I finally did find some guy in Vancouver that had one for sale on Etsy. So I kind of looked into him, and I actually bought one. And so did my fiance, Sarah, but she did it without telling me, and she was going to do it for a surprise. And she was really, wasn't very happy with me when mine came in the mail before hers, but yeah, that's kind of how it started, and I just liked it. So I kind of did some research, and I started banging holes in medallions and started wrapping them around this ring mandrel, and from there, I kind of started to get into this little, like they have their own little Facebook page where everybody kind of shares their tricks and their trades and new tools that they come, and it turned into a kind of an art. You know, it's great because people will call me, say, hey, you know, they'll tell me their whole story, their recovery story, and I'll be at work, and I got to run home and make these people ring because their story is are just so touching. And so I run home and whip out their ring. You know, it takes me an hour to make it and then either clean it and get it out to them. But I'm just pumped to be able to do that. So it's been a great little hobby, and it's kind of takes off. You know, if I do a little advertising, it takes off. But right now I'm so busy, I don't even advertise it a whole lot. But
yeah, well, it seems like you've got so many aspects of your life right now that revolve around recovery. So that's very exciting stuff. Like, for example, the peer recovery specialist. You know, I was asking you earlier about, you know, if you were an addictions counselor or you were a recovery coach. You said, no, you know, I'm technically a peer recovery specialist. So right now you're going to school. Tell us a little bit about, you know, how that evolved and why you're a peer recovery specialist.
All right. Yeah, the school, again, fell in my lap. High school came easy to me. I didn't like it. I went there on Mondays to get my homework. Went there on Fridays to turn my homework in, find out where the party was. And we parted ways. But you know, 25 years later, after I went into treatment, I heard about this addiction counseling course offered in Minneapolis at a community college. And I thought, you know, this is what I need to do. I need to find out why I'm an addict. I knew I come from a family of addicts. So I wanted to know how my brain worked. And it kind of started out as I'm going to do it for myself, maintenance. And as I did more schooling, you know, I found out I didn't know as much as I thought I did. When I was a drunk, I knew everything. And I started school. You know, the more I learned, the more I needed to learn. And so then it took off into, I told my counselor at treatment that I was going to take his job. And me being a stubborn addict, I kept at it at school. But you know, now the school, I did as much as I could at that community college. And now I've moved on to a bigger state university. And it's life changing. It's completely different. Now I'm actually working on the master's part of it. I haven't done none of my practicums in order to get my associate's degree, my bachelor's degree. So I just skipped them because I'm going to get it all at the same time at the end. There's no reason for me to give up my construction job and my clients
right. Until
I'm ready to go all in. Because Minnesota's got some good tradition of treatments, and this peer recovery specialty is great, but the money difference. I got six kids. I got to feed them.
Six kids?
Six.
Wow, man. Okay, now I understand. Holy moly, that keeps you busy.
For sure. So now I've started on the master's part of the program, and as of right now, my grades are still, I don't have 4.0 anymore. I lost that last semester, but I'm still 3.8. So I'm doing good enough. I'm getting scholarships for the school, and I'm going to keep on going. I wanted a doctorate because you can't make no money until you write the book. And if you don't have doctor behind your name, not that I'll ever write a book, but...
I got you. So there's a lot of, you have some big lofty goals as far as where you want to go with this.
For sure.
A book could be one thing, but ultimately, what's the title you're looking to acquire?
There's no title that I'm looking to acquire. This peer recovery specialist, it's even better than being a counselor.
Okay.
To me, so far, I'm not a whole lot into it, but I get to go to this drug court and be a part of somebody's recovery. Even when I was in treatment, watching other people have 17 treatments in and out of treatment is pretty normal. 12 to 15 is a normal thing. And what this Minnesota Recovery Connections, I kind of fell in with them. They taught me to do this. That's a whole other story. They taught me to do everything. I kind of went under their wing, and they taught me, started out as a peer recovery telephone support. And that was the first classes that they offered for training, and it was free. And it was two Thursday nights, 6 hours total, six to nine on two different Thursday nights. And you got this, just a little certificate from them saying you can come in and make, they have a phone bank, and people sign up to receive a phone call. So that's kind of how it all started there. And then from that, the second stage is kind of this outreach, which we go around to treatment centers and I get to speak, let them know what Minnesota Recovery Connection is all about. I get to go to sober homes. I get to go to jails. It's all everything to do with recovery. It's all day, every day with me.
Awesome. Awesome. I love it. All right. So you've got a lot going on recovery wise. You spend a lot of time in the Share Podcast private group. So there's definitely a lot of outreach that you do as far as connecting with other recovering addicts, which I'm assuming it plays a huge role in your own sobriety.
Oh, for sure. It's kind of how I found out about the Share program was the guy that made Sober and Serious. He was on your show, episode 91. I'll never forget because I listened to 90 episodes of your show in 9 days, and I was comparing it to how the AA thing goes. But it was listening to his interview is how I found out about you, and then I just got hooked immediately, and I started listening from the beginning, and it was nice at work. 8 hours I got to listen, it's about seven of them a day, averaging, weekends a little more, and makes the day at work go by. You've had some pretty amazing people on your show. Some people that a lot of them I've got to meet in person. Nikki Myers, she comes to Minnesota and speaks with us in Minnesota Recovery Connection, and it's just great. All the people you've had. So I'm an addict. I got hooked.
I love it, man. That is so awesome. All right. So tell us how much clean time you have, and when is your anniversary date?
My anniversary date is July 16th, 2012. And, normally I don't notice what day it is. Is it a little over 3.5 years, or is it almost 4 years? I haven't figured out what's the best, what sounds the best in my head yet. Because I never have to say it every day. But, you know, now that I started this drug card deal, you know, I've got to do my spiel twice a week. So, yep, I'm coming up on 4 years in July.
Excellent. So,
not a whole lot.
Trust me, man. You know, there's very few of us. You know, it's 1 in 10 that make it the first year. It's, you know the numbers. It's stacked against us.
Oh, sure is. I've seen it. Yep.
So tell us how old you were the first time you drank or used drugs, and more importantly, how did they make you feel?
Oh, boy. Oh, I've been kicking this around since the first time I listened to your first episode, Keith Campbell from Sober and Serious. The first time, you know, I don't even remember. It's kind of stories that hearing from my uncles and grandmas and my mom and my dad. And I was told at 2 years old, I would go up, you know, they had little card games, poker games and stuff like that. And at 2 years old, the next morning, I was reaching up, trying to sip on the last bit of whatever, the melted ice cube and Southern Comfort. And obviously I don't remember none of that. But that's the stories I grew up. And I even went and I wanted to talk to my mom. I called her up a few times and I wanted to get the story straight, because if I'm going to be telling my story, you know how things get exaggerated over the years and everything. So I want to keep it on the up and up. So the first time I remember was age 13, you know, where I went over to a friend from hockey. A hockey player has got to be cool. And I grew up around alcoholism and marijuana use, a lot of it. It was like a cigarette to me, you know. Everybody, I didn't notice it. But the first time I remembered, we were drinking, and I loved the feeling. I loved the numbness. I loved being able to get away with it. I loved that, you know, there was three of us buddies, hockey players, you know. Our moms and dads were all drinking at the poker table, so they didn't even understand what we were getting into. And then they broke out the pot, and I one puff of that, and luckily I was spinning and sick. I could not walk. I could not see. So I really stayed away from that, you know, with all my relatives doing it. It really wasn't a big thing to me. The drinking was because my dad was in recovery and he didn't drink. And he went like 13 years. I remember that being a kind of a cool thing. I always thought, you know, people that don't drink were cool. But for some reason, I still kept at it.
So your dad is in recovery?
My dad's got five brothers. All four of the five were alcoholics or used marijuana, you know, or addicts in some way.
Right.
They're all pretty much all in recovery now.
That's
my grandpa's
awesome.
In recovery. Yeah, I mean, growing up, to me, we have this old AA mansion downtown Minneapolis that's called 2218. And I remember going there, and it was a treat as a kid. You know, they'd have like little carnivals. And I mean, I'm still scared of clowns today because, you know, the clowns there had one tooth. And but I remember how much fun it was, Grandpa bringing me to the AA meeting. So, I mean, I grew up around it. I knew all about AA. I knew all about NA. But I still, you know, still kept going right down that path.
I gotcha. All right. Well, Chris, guess what, man? You're all warmed up, man. So it's time for me to turn this show over to you. Time for you to share your story, the battle against drugs and alcohol, the wreckage it caused in your life, when you hit rock bottom, and then finally your journey into recovery up until today. So Chris, take it away, buddy.
All right. Oh, yeah. From, you know, 13, 14 years old, it was, you know, just getting away with it on the weekends, you know, when our families would have poker games. And, you know, from there, it kind of took off into high school. We'd sneak it on the hockey bus. Like I said, you know, us hockey players always had to be cool. And so somebody was always sneaking it on. And I knew right away I wasn't going to be good at drinking. I did it every time. I would puke. And I just knew I wasn't going to be good at it. But I liked it. And I just kept at it. So as I got older, out of high school, my grandpa had a bricklaying company, and so he kind of took me under his wing, and he was in recovery. So that was probably some of the best thing that could have happened to me, because after high school hockey was done, and it was all end up either partying or whatever, but he was handing, you know, $100 bills out every week. So I just stuck with Grandpa. But the thing is, now I'm in this bricklayer's trade, and, you know, the construction workers here in Minnesota, we got to stick to the stigma of, you know, whistling at girls and going to the bar every day after work. Which, of course, you know, I couldn't do when I was around my grandpa because he was in recovery.
Right.
You know, my addiction hadn't kicked in high gear at that time. So the grandpa passed me off on this bigger company out of Philadelphia that was in town for a little while. And so now I got to go travel out of town, 18 years old. I got to travel with, you know, the big dogs, the big construction workers.
Right.
And of course, I'm 18-year-old punk kid, and I think my first trip was out to Butte, Montana, and of course, I, you know, we drank all day. Those guys from Philly, they had bottles of vodka in their back pocket, and it was Norton, and that's all I got to see. You know, they drink it when they wake up, they drink it at lunch, they drink it. So I thought I was going to keep up with them. Long story short, I ended up in jail for the first time in 18. Bought a fake crossbow pistol that shot little darts. And, of course, being drunk, when a out-of-town police officer drove by, I put it under my shirt, so they got me for a concealed weapon.
Oh.
Which, you know, kind of sounds like no big deal. But then after 9/11, and I work construction, trying to get an airport pass, I'm a superintendent of the job, and I have to have my laborers show me around because I still have this charge showing up. You know, it still haunts me to this day.
Oh, wow.
You know, it was like a $100 fine back then. It was no big deal. But, you know, that was the first stupid thing running with the law, and there's plenty more after that. But, so construction, and I figured out the out of town wasn't so great for me. So I actually quit drinking right before my 21st birthday on my own, and took up with this company that I knew the guy, he didn't drink. So I started working with him, and nobody had pushed me to quit drinking. It's just, I just knew, you know, I couldn't do it. And we were out in Chicago on my 21st birthday, and I remember we were at this bar, and I drank non-alcoholic beer. We were playing blackjack. I remember I had 30 non-alcoholic beers, and I had the worst headache ever. And I know this because I had tipped her 30, and I remember doing the math after I left. I'm like, after I was broke and lost all my money and had a headache from non-alcoholic beer, and I had tipped her over $150, but... So that was the good part. That job kind of ran off in the wintertime. So I got a job back in Minnesota, another out of town crew. And then that's when the drinking really took off. Cause, I got introduced to cocaine for the first time. And when I was drunk, I wouldn't say no to nothing.
Right.
I never knew what cocaine was really. Pretty much just been around pot. The cocaine, that was like heaven. It sobered me up, or I thought I was sober. You know, I was like, wow, I can drink all over again. And I remember the first time I did it, I just got married. I didn't do it cocaine until I was 24. Just got married, had a kid, and I'm over at this guy's house that I'm trying to impress. I'm drunk after work on a Friday, and he showed me the cocaine, and I did it. And, you know, a whole week, or I was over at just him and his wife. We sat there, and I kept telling him, you know, after I do a line after a line after a line, I kept telling him, I go, I don't even know why you do this stuff. It's not even any good. You know, it's kind of stupid because, you know, you get drunk, then you get sober, and you get drunk, then you get sober. I'll never forget this. He looked right at me and he says, Chris, it's Sunday. Go home. We have to work tomorrow. So 3 days had gone by. Friday after work. And now it's Sunday. I did not realize. I'll never forget that. And from there, it was on. I got back to my buddies. And we had, like, softball tournaments. Played softball every night of the week. You know, just to have an excuse to get out and drink, basically.
Right.
All of a sudden, my buddies, I kind of showing them, hitting around, you know, and all of a sudden they're like, Chris, you know, we've been doing cocaine the whole time. We just thought you were against it, so we've always been hiding it. I mean, I'm talking 50 buddies. All already doing it. They've been doing it since high school, but they just thought I was against it. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. So me working out of town and working out of all these other states, I'd bring them, you know, bring them back even better stuff. So it was on for a good 10 years, just drinking and cocaine, basically. One day somebody cooked some up, and I took a hit off and smoked crack. I always called it purified cocaine because it sounded cooler. I didn't want to be a crackhead, but that was a whole new game. I liked that even more.
Of course.
So I would do that, and I would, you know, learn how to cook it, and I'd do it, but I'd always feel really bad about myself the next day. So then I would get drunk, of course.
Right.
And then now I don't need, you know, I don't need any coke. I don't need any crack because I feel bad. But then all of a sudden you have that one beer too many, and all of a sudden the right person walks by, and then it's all over again. And honestly, that happened for 10 years. And I remember looking back thinking, meanwhile, I'm divorced, but I went 12 years. I can't think of a day that I did not drink alcohol. 12 years. So, you know, after all said and done, I had 26 years of using and abusing. Alcohol was my first, but like I said, as soon as I'm drinking, I would do anything.
Of course.
I even ran into another company. I get clean for spells, not, you know, just on my own accord. Being at bars, I'll run into somebody that doesn't drink, and I always admired them. Like, wow, why don't you drink? And so I respected that, and I'd always, you know, kind of hide my drinking from them and hang out with them and, you know, encourage them to, you know, continue their sobriety. It's just always, always something. I know. It sounds ridiculous.
No, I remember that, dude. Keep it up, man. It's so awesome, dude. Meanwhile, you're trashed.
Right. Yes.
Been there,
I can't
done
even
that.
Think of what they were thinking about me.
Of like, course. Idiot, you know?
So, yeah, I don't... I got back here, and the cocaine, you know, I kind of kept coming, switching companies. It's pretty normal in Minnesota. It gets so cold in the winter times as a construction worker. You know, usually we go south and or Vegas in the winter or San Diego in the winter. You know, they're nice kind of places for an addict to end up for that 3 months, you know, making $3,000, $5,000 a week.
Oh, wow.
But, yeah, so I knew the out of town stuff had to stop. But when I got back here, I met a guy. He did meth. And, I had never tried. Or actually, it was crank. It started out. It was crank, and I don't even think crank is even a thing anymore. But instead of snorting coke, we would snort this crank, or they'd put it in a napkin and you'd swallow it. And your hair would grow for 3 days. You could not sleep or eat. So I didn't really like that. But that's all that seemed to be around for a couple of years.
Horrible.
Yeah, horrible. And they used to call it dirt farming. And they'd make, even the people that did coke would make fun of the people that did meth. Because, you're a dirt farmer. It's like, we're all drug addicts, whatever. But, you know, I'm hanging out with people. You find some meth, and they'd rip a light bulb out of the ceiling and heat it up, poke a hole in it so quick, so fast, make a pipe. And I thought it was cool. I know, I'm learning, you know, I'm learning tricks of the trade. So I would do the meth on and off only if the cocaine wasn't around. But most of it was just drinking all day, every day at work. Superintendent of big profile, $1 million jobs, and I have to drink at 5 o'clock in the morning to get rid of the shakes. I'd wake up. I got a little studio apartment. My fiance now, she did luckily come back. Sarah had left me after I got divorced, and then Sarah, who I have four kids with now, she had left me because of my drinking, and we were living with her brother, and that didn't go so well. So she left because we kind of used each other to drink all day, every day, in the mornings, because we were laid off, geek out and play PlayStation and drink two cases of beer and a bottle of vodka and hot 100 or anything strong, basically. She had left, so I figured I'll show her. I'm going to move downtown St. Paul. I had got back with one of my old companies, making good money, living in hotels, up until I could afford this apartment, a little studio apartment right above a bar. Probably not the wisest choice, but it happened.
You think?
And everywhere I went, first thing I do is find the bar managers or the owners. And I'm like, you're my best friend. If you need help, I'll help you. You help me. Keep them shut up about my drinking. That way nobody can judge me. I manipulated everybody before they even knew that they were getting manipulated.
Of course.
And when you can manipulate yourself, you know you're good. So, actually, the drinking hit pretty good there. Being single, I'd pretend. I got 3 DWIs along the way. On one of the last ones, I lied really, really bad. I hit a guy. Me and the guy from work, we had a rain day, and we were at bars, and I rear-ended somebody at a stoplight and tried taking off, drinking and driving. I don't remember driving until I hit him. I remember my hood and my minivan going flying up. And I took off, and I was trying to run, I guess, and I told my buddy, it was the dead of winter, or just started winter, but I told my buddy to take off running because my van was starting on fire, and I was going from 60 miles an hour now to about 10, and the guy I hit is behind me, and I can see he's on a cell phone. So I told him, I'm gonna pull over, I want you to run. And luckily he did. He got away because I slid over the passenger seat and got out, and I just made up a huge story, and I got away with one. And
what was the story?
That would fix me. I told him I picked up some Bob Johnson, was at the bar, and he wanted to go to another bar. He was from Florida. He had a plowing company, but I told him I was too drunk to drive. He said he'd drive my van. And for 3 years, they had investigators. We know it was you, Chris. You just admit it. They let me out of jail. I have no idea how I walked out. But I did. They investigated me for 3 years, and finally just, it was gone. They let me go. So, but that wasn't even enough to fix it. Ended up getting another one, rear-ended, actually a buddy going from one bar to another bar, and a cop just happened to be sitting there watching me do it. So that was my third DWI, which is when I had to go to jail for, that was my longest jail time, was like 28 days, something ridiculous. I know it was not much to most people that are in my recovery community, but to me, it was a lifetime.
Dude, 28 days? I've never spent 28 days in jail. I'm out.
Right.
No thanks.
And the judge ordered me to go to an outpatient treatment. I bullshitted my way through the guy that that asked me all the questions. I bullshitted my way through the treatment. They gave me a stone. They said I was the best recovery ever. Meanwhile, I'm driving my bike 10 miles to get to the recovery place, and then I'd get leave treatment, and I was straight to the bar. And I'd continue to drink until I got drunk and go home, and I faked it. I thought I could fake it till I made it, but I didn't. I slowly got back into drinking. But then, I don't know, one day living in St. Paul, I figured I woke up and I had a half-gallon bottles of the cheapest tequila or whatever vodka there was.
Mm-hmm.
And they were everywhere. They cleaned out my job locker when I left my company. Buddies of mine cleaned it out, and there was, I think they said there was over 20 bottles come tumbling out. I'm hanging 100, 50 stories in the air, leaning over the building, and I'm probably about a 2.0. I knew I had a problem, and I'd bet people that, oh, I'll quit drinking, and so I'd buy a breathalyzer to, so I could figure out how to manipulate that damn breathalyzer so I could show them, hey, see, I'm not drinking. But yet I'd have one hidden in the rain gutter, a block away, so I could get to it when I needed to. There was one morning I just woke up, and there was a girl that told me that something about this recovery community, and I remember looking at her, and I just told her, recovery community, and she's this band geek. I say that in the nicest way. This musician, and I'm like, I'm too cool for your recovery community. And she wasn't in the recovery. She was real awesome. And she hung out with artsy people and a lot of the LGB community, and just people I didn't, but that were in recovery, but just people that I just wouldn't click with. I'm a Chris Falk. I'm a drunk, so.
I'm too cool for this.
So I didn't really buy her story. One day when I started, I told myself I was going to walk into a detox, but I had to go to the liquor store first. So I walked up to the liquor store. I knew, I had liquor stores that open at 8 a.m. And there I was waiting in line for them to open. I got my bottle, enough to get drunk and be able to blow numbers to go into this detox. And I got 3 steps away from it, and I ran out of vodka, so I had to walk back, go get another bottle.
Oh, Jesus.
So I started kind of chickening out. This time I only got like a half a pint, but it was still 100 proof vodka. I mean, I had to have the strong stuff. It was no use of drinking the water down.
No, of course not.
But, so now that's kicking in, I'm trying to second guess myself into getting into the detox. As a matter of fact, I got lost walking around downtown St. Paul. I forgot where the detox was. So I called that one girl and I said, remember that recovery community you were talking about? I told her what street I was on, and she come flying by, picked me up. Of course, I had another bottle hidden in my pocket, and I threw it in her back seat, and I said, I'm ready. That was it. I said, I'm ready. So she directed me and made sure that I walked into the first door of the detox, because when you're in there, this is downtown St. Paul. It's not the greatest neighborhood, but as soon as that door clicks, you're stuck. And I remember thinking, I was going to open that door again, thinking hopefully she would be gone. But door clicked, and here I am going into detox. I only blew like a 0.37, which was enough to get to stay there for 4 nights. And I just told him, I was open and honest. I said, this time, I'm going to be honest with everybody. And this lady is asking me the questions about my using, and I told her everything, which was hard for me to do, because usually, you got to hide it because you don't want.
Right.
You tell them everything.
Of course.
But I told it like I needed it, and I told her, I want to go to treatment. I want to take that pill, and do my 28 days and come out and go back to work and do my life. And she laughed. there's no pill, evidently, and 28 days wasn't going to quite cut it for me. She told me that if I wasn't willing to give up 2 years of my life, quit my job, quit everything, that I was hopeless case. And, I was already having health problems, you know, pancreas is acting up. And but when she said 2 years, quit my job, I mean, I had a pretty decent job, you know, being the boss and everything. That 2 years really, really sank home. And all I could think about was, I think my oldest boy was 17 at the time, because I had to do it for him, because he had finally asked me one time, when you got to quit drinking, you know, showing up to his football and baseball drunk, I'd have to go sit out in the outfield. No. He was finally catching on why, man. I'm out there by myself, you know.
Yeah.
So that was tough. So the 2 year thing really hit home, and that one registered. And I think that's when that was my surrender. And I remember feeling the weight go off, and I said, I'm going to do everything you say. And I told this lady, I've actually gone back looking for her because, I owe her a little bit of a thanks. But she told me she'd find me a bed, and it was hard. All of a sudden, she kept me as long as I could. It was like on to day five, and I was still all gung-ho, you know, I'm doing this. And she says, the good news is I finally found you a bed. The bad news is it's not till tomorrow, and we have to release you today. And I told her, I'm going to drink. I know I will. She goes, that's okay if you do, kind of. You know, she didn't say that. Yeah, she did. And she kind of gave me the okay. She goes, you're detoxed. She goes, you're probably going to drink. She goes, you just make sure you get there in the morning. And I promised her I would. And she just looked, you know, looked deep into her eyes. And she looked deep in my eyes. And there was no getting out of it. And that's kind of the day that the stubborn addict took over. And I just reversed roles and used my powers of being an addict for the good instead of the bad, because there's some good qualities that addicts have.
Absolutely. No question about it.
When I walked in that treatment door, I think another big thing that helped was there was a guy that looked at me, shook my hand as I'm walking in, nervous, still drunk from the night before. You know, not too bad, though. I mean, I did pretty good. I think I was 0.10. That's, I functioned at a 2.20 all day, every day at work.
So you had a mild buzz going.
Right. Enough to function. But I remember when he said, you know, you're in the right spot. Yeah. I looked at him, you know, I'm like, you know what? I really am. So that began my treatment. I told my counselor, like I said earlier, I'm going to take your job from you. I've gone, you know, now that I'm in my fourth year of schooling, I've gone and interviewed him for a class. And I think I actually got him worried a little bit now.
Worried in a good way, I'm sure.
Worried in a good way, for sure, yes. So that's pretty much my story. Oh, it's in the big book. You can read it.
It's right next to mine, brother.
Right next to yours.
It's right next to mine.
I'm working on the recovery part is the better part of the story, for sure.
Well, let's dive into that. You know, I'll tell you this much. You know, I wish more people, it's tough because I know a lot of people, especially in the recovery community, want to soft sell what exactly is that you're about to embark upon, because nobody wants to tell somebody that they're going to be 2 years of their life is going to have to be dedicated to recovery.
Right.
Because most people are like, fuck this, I'm out of here. 2 years. I'll do it for 28 days. I remember, you probably heard the episode of the kid that I was trying to get him into a rehab center. And when he found out he was going to be there for 90 days, he flipped out. Like, I've got all this stuff going on. I'm like, dude, you're banging dope. Just living on the streets. What pressing matters could you possibly have? And so, right. So for that counselor to say that, right? I mean, like, I'm all about it. Then it's the truth. You know, if you want to recover, you've got 12 years of just beaten the crap out of yourselves. Doing drugs, drinking alcohol every single day. You put your family through hell for years. And how are you going to fix that in 28 days? Can you explain that to me?
Take that magic pill.
It's that magic pill, which I love that. You know, what's my, give me the magic pill so I can stop. But the beautiful thing is you had this gift of desperation. You wanted to stop. You had had enough. And so as much as what you heard you did not like, it was like, okay, I guess I got to do this. I guess I got to do this. So tell us about those, that first year in recovery.
First year in recovery was tough. It wasn't 28 days. I did 6 months in an inpatient.
Wonderful.
Well, no, I did 18 weeks of inpatient, and then they graduated me from inpatient, but then I had to do like start kind of an outpatient deal, mm-hmm. which started out with 5 days a week and went to 4 days a week, 3 days a week, until it got to 2 days a week. And then that was, you graduate from outpatient, and then it kicks into aftercare, which you got to do 2 days a week for another year. So it took over the 2 years to get all three of my certificates that hang above my office wall, inpatient, outpatient, and aftercare.
That's awesome.
And from there, I actually went above and beyond. I did the transitional housing, it's kind of a sober home. You get 2 years to live there, and they kick you out. But you got your own room, thank goodness, because I've heard so many horror stories. I tell you, the own room saved me. I like people, but not sleeping with them. I think that, you know, I was listening to your interview last week and about the sober homes, and I got lucky. I had the top of the line sober house. It was awesome. There was only 19 of us in this little old mansion. And it was in the middle of nowhere on a lake next to a park. I got to go fishing. I got to go, you know, I got to go to my school. I got to do everything. It was awesome. The sober transitional housing was made or made, you know, make it or break it. And we did our AA meetings there. So it was 2 years of that. And then the girlfriend, or the ex-girlfriend, slowly started coming back. God bless her. So we started talking, and, you know, she was proud of, you know, what I was doing. I didn't even tell her I was in treatment. I don't even know how she found out or how she, you know, whatever. And we only had one kid at the time together. So she come back, and we actually found a house to rent, thank goodness, with, you know, my criminal record. And I forgot to tell you a little piece. I got in a little trouble, ended up with a terroristic threat charge. Some crackhead was grabbed my 5-year-old son's hood, and I ran in and grabbed his BB gun and scared him away. And I ended up with, 2 hours later, with admitting to the police. You know, I told them about it, and of course I did.
Well, I mean, in all fairness, I get that one.
Right. Yes.
I get that one, man. I'm going to fuck that guy up, man.
Oh, yeah. Yep. So I got this little charge on me. It's called the terroristic threat, and they wanted to do it as a felony because the state took over. The police officers were awesome. But they had called in the SWAT team and looking for 2 hours. I didn't know. I mean, we went and played video games with me and my kid. It wasn't an issue. I was in my apartment. I had no idea none of this was going on for 2 hours. So they had brought a SWAT team in looking for a man with a gun. And it was a soft pellet BB gun that my kid, I grabbed out of his toy box to scare these guys away. You know? So I got it. The state takes over and they wanted a charge on me, so... luckily, I had the greatest judge in the world. She read my story, and she's like, don't worry, I'll do my best. And she goes, she had to be the judge every time, so she kept me. And you know, she got it dropped down to a gross misdemeanor. I had zero jail time. I had zero fines. I had zero anything. But I still got to keep this thing on my record, and she's going to expunge it, but I got to wait till 4 years after the probation, which ended 2 years. So I got another 2 years to get it expunged and off my record. And supposedly that's better than a presidential pardon.
All right. All right. Excellent.
Meanwhile, it's still going to be on there. And that's affected a few things along the way.
Those things typically do.
Yeah. But
consequences.
So where was I? Since I got off track.
No, well, you'd already gone, you know, we were in your first year of recovery, and you were living in a really badass mansion, sober home, and then you got back with the girlfriend.
Right.
You know, you guys have you guys rented a place together. Okay, that's where you left off.
We did. We moved in together, and she's got an older boy, and I got an older boy, and we had one boy together, and then we had our first sober kid. I call her my sober kid, Johanna. Johanna Grace, which means God's gracious gift, is what I read it out of this Bible book. And that's how I chose her name, because I got a gracious gift of recovery from God.
I love
that. So that's how I, and so my fiance is 11 years younger than me, so she wanted another kid. I'm 44 now. And then she actually wanted another one, but I had talked her out of it.
Good job.
I did. Dude. I went and got snipped.
Good for you, man.
The doctor canceled the appointment because there was a snowstorm here in Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
And postponed it a month. So by the time I got it, it was too late. So now we got two sober girls. The grand total of six kids. We have four together, but no, all is good. I mean, my oldest boy is in college, first year of college, and I have four kids in the house, and then I have one girl, two that I don't have full custody of, but I get to see her whenever I want, and I mean, life is really awesome, and the kids are really awesome. Yeah, and that's where we live today. We're actually looking for our first home. We got approved for a lending to buy a home. It's just... every step I take, the door is open. It's really amazing. Everything they told me, it all comes true.
It certainly does, man. There is no question about it. There are so many miracles that happen to us, especially guys with stories like yours. I've interviewed a few guys that have the same story. Same with Sober and Serious.
Yes, Keith.
Yeah, with Keith. You know, Keith's got a very similar story, man. You know,
for
convicted
sure.
Felon. He's got a bunch of kids. He's got to, you know, be accountable, responsible now. And then the guy's now, he's getting remarried, and his community,
awesome,
his Facebook. Yeah, awesome. Yep. His community is growing, thriving.
Almost 6,000 people on Sober and Serious. He let me be an admin because I use Sober and Serious. He invited me onto it when there's 300 of us at first, and it started growing, and I used it as a tool. I ended up meeting Keith. He lives here in Minnesota, so I met him, and he wanted a ring. He didn't have a car at the time, so I went and picked him up. He lived, I don't know, 10 miles away, picked him up and brought him over to my house, and I said, "You're making it yourself." And that was the first time I ever met him. I didn't know him, and I've done this for a few people. I don't know if he's a killer or what, and I had to make sure the kids are in the house and everything's safe. But him and I kicked it off great, and so I kind of knew him. And all that Sober and Serious, you know, he lets me do the admin thing so that I can use it to advertise for my Walk for Recovery. We do a huge Walk for Recovery in Minnesota, and we're like for 10 years, and so we have our team name is Sober and Serious, and I made up T-shirts and everything. And Keith is great, and that's why, like I said, that's how I got put on to you.
That's amazing.
For sure.
It's such a small world, and when you're connected, you know, in the right direction, then, you know, the universe plugs you in with the right people. And when you're going in the wrong direction, plugs you in with the wrong people. I mean, whichever path you seek, you will find, you know.
It's true. And it's pick your bumper sticker. Pick it and live by it. It's true.
It's absolutely true. And it's wonderful to watch. It's wonderful to watch the miracles that happen, you know, in recovery. You know, so many of us have these amazing lives now, and we started out in absolute misery, you know, losing everything, being a complete train wreck, embarrassing our friends, embarrassing our family, embarrassing ourselves, you know, and ultimately almost killing ourselves with the amount of drugs and alcohol that we were doing, you know, and then we get this reprieve, just by turning it over, man. You just surrender and you start giving it back, and then boom, you start getting. It's just, I guess it's just the universal law.
For sure. The surrender is huge. That's when the weight, that's the first spiritual experience. That's the surrender was it.
No, it's beautiful, man. And you know, it's so great to see someone, you know, that just, and just absolutely embraced the program so strong after, you know, so many years of being out there and being in denial about who you are and what you're doing. And then, you know, it's funny though, because we are addicts. So when something starts to feel good, right, we just want to just keep more and more and more and more. And recovery is no different.
Right.
Yeah, we get a high. I get a high from it, man. You know,
and you bet.
So it's like it feels so good. It's like I want to do some more of this. I mean, if it didn't feel good, we wouldn't be doing it. Period.
Right.
We're not some sort
God
of
God bumps.
Yeah.
I heard one of your first episodes. It was like number 5 or 6. I can't remember the lady's
Leanne.
Name. She said Leanne. Uh-huh. I wrote. I messaged her and friended her. I'm like, can I please steal that God bumps? I mean, it happens to me 100 times a day. And in Minnesota, we say goosebumps, but God bumps was, that's my line now. She said I could have it.
There's so many correlations, and it's great. I mean, the community has managed to pull itself together and become so close, the recovery community. I'm very proud to be out and open about my recovery, you know, not being anonymous. And giving people the opportunity to reach out when they need the help, because that's basically what we need. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've gotten emails or messages from people that said, man, I refuse to go to meetings until I just heard, you know, enough of your podcast, or I was like, I think I'm going to give this a shot. And then now they go to regular meetings, man. It's just it's a bridge to connection, because seriously, even just the podcasts are great, but I mean, as far as I'm concerned, we can't do this alone.
No.
And so you need to connect with others, spend time with others, be a part of your own community, build a community. And then from there, you completely break away from everything that was before. The old you no longer exists. The new you emerges, and you have new friends, new outlook, and an absolutely new way of being. It's an amazing thing.
For sure. Truly. I mean, I thank you for the share podcast. The recovery page is phenomenal. The people I've been able to meet, Jenny Reese, she's been phenomenal. With
she's pretty amazing.
She's
that
done.
One.
Yeah. For sure. Big Jim, him and I hit it off. I've spoke with him a few times on the phone, and actually, I called you to put you onto him because
he
impressed me so much. I'm like, push my interview off. You got to get this Big Jim in here. This guy, I don't have the gift of gab like him, and he's got people working through him, and his girlfriend Marisol. They have something going on, and they're bringing some big awareness out. And you know, we're doing a lot of awareness here in Minnesota. But to be on a national level, it's his idea, is, you know, bigger and better. And I've actually, he invited me to be a part of his team and join his board of directors. And I mean, we've hit it off big time. So just from people in your show, and then your recovery community joins with my recovery community, joins with Keith's recovery community, you know, that's the connection that we're talking about. We need the connections where it's at.
It's all there.
It is. I appreciate everything you do.
Well, thank you, brother. You know, and I appreciate everything you do. Like I said in the beginning, you're one of the most active members in the group. And I wouldn't have done the gym interview if it wasn't for you. You set it all up. So it made it very easy. So I appreciate
well,
that.
Well, and I wouldn't have run into gym if it wasn't for Jenny praying with them on the side of the road.
That's you right. Know? That's right.
It's just, it trinkles. It's all working out.
Well, good, good. All right, buddy. Well, we've come to that part of the show where it's time to close down and answer some questions for the newcomer. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right, let's do this. So, Chris, number one, what was keeping you from getting clean or staying clean when you first got introduced to recovery?
My ego, for sure. I mean, I knew I was a professional alcoholic. I would say it to people. I thought, now knowing, I was a professional alcoholic. I didn't need to quit. I was better than everybody else at it. No matter how many times the police pulled me over, how many bar fights, how many anything, I was still the best at it.
So delusional.
For sure.
I love it, man. All right. So tell us, at what point did you have a spiritual awakening, that aha moment in recovery when you accepted that you were powerless over drugs and alcohol, but for the first time had developed the hope that you could recover?
To me, it wasn't a big bang. It wasn't the big bang theory. It was slowly, I'd have to look back on them and be, and I'd have my aha moments, and I have them daily now. It's like, it's so obvious. It's just, I think my first one looking back was when the lady says, this is going to take 2 years. And I remember like, you're bullshitting me. Like, no, 2 years. That was my first one. But looking back now, there's so many of them every day. It's so awesome. It's like, even doing the prescription drugs, they put me on these prescription drugs. Well, I know I'm an AA guy. I can't be doing that. But looking back on it, it's like, well, you know what? I haven't been angry in 3 months. I haven't been, I haven't had, I got diagnosed with bipolar and PTSD, which I don't even know. The guy interviewed me for 15 minutes and he diagnosed me with three, four different things and six different pills. And it's like, no, this isn't how it's going to work. And so I'm still in a big fight with that. I'm not, the pill part really bugs me. And then, but as long as the doctor says, I'm good with it.
It's a process, man. All of it is a process. And I have talked to so many people, my mother's bipolar and she's come off the meds and it's just horrible, unfortunately there is an imbalance,
there's
so many of us in addiction that are battling with that. And prior to, what we were doing was we were just self-medicating, right? So right. The idea is that, we start taking directions in a different way to manage it, so we don't run out in the streets and start medicating ourselves again. Because that, ultimately could be, the road we choose if we're not careful. So I hear you, brother. You got to do what you got to do. And it's all about living a life of happiness.
It is.
Free from active addiction.
Yeah.
All right. So number three, do you have a favorite book that you would recommend to a newcomer that you read in early recovery?
Oh, man. I have so many. I'm an Audible addict now. I'm an Audible junkie. I have my earbuds in all day, every day at work. When I'm driving, pumping that stuff in my head, whether it be religious books, AA books, NA books. The biggest, my most favorite audiobook is called The Four Best Places to Live. It's Mark Buchanan. I think it's only on audio. I actually bought it, a DVD, so I could have it and share it and give it to people, instead of giving them my Amazon or my Audible account, here, take this and listen to it. It's just the four best places to live in God's eye, instead of Fortune magazine, where's the best places to live in God's eye? And it teaches you how to pray. It teaches you expectancy, and it's great. I listen to it once a month.
What's the name of it again?
It's called The Four Best Places to Live by Mark Buchanan.
Beautiful.
That's just a great book. I mean, otherwise, every book that everybody's ever said on your show, I have downloaded on my Audible. I'm telling you.
It does help, man. It makes such a difference.
It does.
And when you can listen to, recovery related material or listen to audiobooks or whatever the case may be, you're feeding your mind, man. And it's it's helping you, the more you can cram in there, in a day, the better you are, right? You'll get you'll get little nuggets here and there. And that's really what it's all about. You pick up one thing every day and, you have 365 new things at the end of the year. So I feel you.
Well, Think and Grow Rich. I just got done with that one yesterday.
Love that.
I heard you guys talking about it.
The Alchemist.
Yep. Breathing underwater. I mean, there's just so many. I don't know. Like I said, I got a new addiction and it's Audible. And I always thought when it first came out, I'm like, who the heck is going to pay money for an Audible book? This business. Yeah, I know. I said, this business is going to go out of business so fast. No, I got my prescription. I'm in.
All right. Beautiful. Yeah. Beautiful. All right. So number four, what is the best suggestion you have ever received?
Let people help. If somebody offers help, let them. You know, work in construction. I work on skyscrapers, but every now and then we get to work on usually more wealthier homes and famous people. But I remember this little old lady come out, and it was a hot day, and I'm out working, and she brought out this tray of about 10 iced teas with a pitcher and ice and everything. And she's like, here, do you want some tea? And I didn't say no because I didn't want it. I did want it. I wanted it bad. But just my, I don't know what it is. Is that my ego too? I didn't want her to give me something. I don't want her, you know, I thought I was being nice by not taking it. But somebody told me once, he goes, who the hell are you to ruin that lady's life? You know, her day, I mean. All you have to do is take one sip of it, and you just made her day. You gave her God bumps. And I get that all the time now. You know, people offer me help, and it's like, I don't want it, but I take it. Because I know it does something good for them. Because I know when I offer my help, it does something good for me. And the more you give, the more you get. It's one of the most true statements I've ever felt.
It's true, and what it is, it's not so much ego. It's more of, when we come into recovery, we have a tough time learning how to love ourselves and how to forgive ourselves, and we don't feel like we deserve anything. We've caused so much damage and so much wreckage. Somebody offers something nice to you, and you're like, I'm not worthy, and I'm not deserving. So you're like, no, thank you, right? Even though you're dying to have it, right? Yeah. Somewhere inside, you have to feel as though, I'm worthy of this. You know, I deserve this. And, you know, as we move along, and it's a great thing to look at. It's not so much, it's true, you know, by accepting, right? She feels good, you feel good, everybody feels good, right? But it's more about what's going on with me. Why, like, for example, me, for a long time, I had a hard time taking compliments. When somebody would say something to me, or like, good job, or, you know, I really appreciate that, or that was awesome, or whatever, and I would be like, it was nothing. Or, you know, downplay it, and constantly downplay it. And I remember one time my sponsor caught it and goes, no, man, you know, you say thank you. When somebody compliments you, you say thank you, and you do it, you know, boldly, and you do it with conviction, you know, because you are worthy. You're not a piece of shit anymore. You know, so that is what weighs into the whole aspect of, you know, not being able to accept goodness into your life is because you just simply don't feel as though you deserve it. And that's something that, you know, once you hear it one time, you're like, wait a minute, I am deserving. And it just, you know, the next time somebody offers you something, you'll feel a little twinge, but you'll say yes.
Yeah, no, I know. And you just reminded me, I did it today. You know, I said, oh, you look nice today. He's like, yeah, no. What are you? Are you a drunk? You know, I always got a smart ass comment. You know, I like being a smart ass yet and having fun. I'm still, you know, the alcohol says, I was told in school that your brain development slows down. Well, my brain's still 14 years old at times. And it's learning. Yep,
arrested development, my friend. Arrested development. That time that you pick up and you ran for 12 years, you know, that's all like one day.
You know? Right. It is.
It's true. It's true.
Oh, I mean, my story is a lot longer, and I jump around. It's just, there's so much in there. And I don't even remember. And that's one of the reasons I told my mom, you know, I want to sit down and talk to you before I do this. So it's all good. It's working out.
Absolutely. And the thing is, man, it's everybody has a story. And the way that Keith's story resonated with you is different than, for example, Bob Apple's resonates with somebody else, or with, you know, that's why there's so many people on the show, because different people connect with different stories, and yours has so many of the same facets as a few of the other guests. It's always nice to be able to be reminded that you're not alone. It's a wonderful thing to always be reminded, man, I'm not alone. This guy's going through the exact same stuff I went through. And it's a wonderful feeling.
It is, truly.
All right, so number five, if you could give a newcomer only one suggestion, what would it be?
Surrender. That's it. Surrender. It's the greatest thing. Surrender is the greatest thing you'll ever do. Let it happen. I mean, pick your bumper sticker and go with it. Whichever one, all the bumper stickers are true, whether they sound ridiculous or not. Pick one and run with it.
Surrender to win, my friend. Surrender to win.
Amen.
That's what they say. All right, Chris, thank you so much for joining us, man.
Thank you all.
This has been awesome, man. I'm so glad we're finally able to make this happen.
Right on. That's all right. I'll wait forever.
You're a good man. All right, folks, yeah. We've now reached the end of our show. Thanks for joining us. And as we say here in Costa Rica, pura vida.
Pura vida, hope.
Thank you for joining us on the Share Recovery Podcast. To check out the show notes page on this interview or to thank our guests for sharing their story, go to www.thesharepodcast.com. While you're on the website, don't forget to sign up for our free newsletter to stay up to date on the latest news, podcasts, and interviews. Want to be one of our guests and share your story? Then go to our website and click on the Share Your Story button. We share our inspiring recovery stories every Tuesday, so subscribe to our show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio to get your free weekly download. We'll see you then. The opinions shared on this show reflect those of the individual speaker and not of any 12-step fellowship as a whole. And though we discuss 12-step recovery and the impact it had in our lives, we do not promote or endorse any 12-step anonymous program.